Hello and welcome to Ask Matt. I'm Eugene Cordero, professor of meteorology and climate science at San Jose State and founder and director of Green Ninja. I'm here with Matt DeLacio, geology professor from Cal State Northridge, national NGSS expert, and one of the chief authors of the 2016 California Science Framework. The format of this podcast is that I ask Matt questions about science, science education, and NGSS, and we'll all learn something more about science education and how to make this transition to NGSS easier and more rewarding for everyone. If you have any of your own questions, just send them to info@greenninja.org, and I'll share some of them with Matt in a future episode. Hey, Matt, nice to see you again. How are you doing?
Doing really well.
Great. Well, for many teachers, this summer was unlike any other in their teaching career. Knowing that instruction would be different, teachers were busy creating new content, participating in professional learning programs, or learning new techniques that they could use in the classroom. I know at San Jose State, about 1,500 professors took a three-week course in remote teaching that turned out to be really good. And although some of this was focused around our technology needs and how to teach remotely, a lot of the instruction was much more fundamental to our core teaching and included topics like inclusion and accommodation for different learning styles. At the university level, I'm sure that some of this content was very new to professor folks like us. So in terms of our university instruction, I think this was a great opportunity to think more deeply about our teaching practice. So Matt, is this educational situation that we find ourselves in today, is it all bad?
Well, I mean, I guess I give the example here that Stanford runs something called its online high school, which it describes as a selective private school for gifted youth. So obviously they think that they can deliver instruction to America's most, or actually the world's most talented students online better than they can in face-to-face, because that's the only way they can do it to everybody around the world. But where does the research fall on this? Well, there's actually a bunch of people that have looked at comparisons of online high schools versus face-to-face high schools. And in Georgia, there's a virtual school there that performed on par with traditional face-to-face schools. And one of the things that we find, though, is that, you know, so you can do it well, but you don't necessarily do it well. In Arizona, a study of online charter schools, where they kind of have the Wild West in terms of their regulation and quality, if you will, their online schools score way lower than traditional high schools do. And so the last kind of really important piece of research is looking not here in California, but in South Carolina, where basically they showed that online test scores correlated really well with how much schools are implementing. Sort of, they have a survey of best practices that are designed, a survey that's designed for brick and mortar schools, for traditional schools. But when they look at which online schools are actually implementing the best practices that face-to-face schools should be doing, the more they do of those best practices, the better the schools do, or the students do, at learning. And so, you know, to get to your point of what it did for university education and your professors, it's about how you teach. So we don't have to be stuck in a terrible situation necessarily. But of course, that doesn't account for the equity issues that we have, where a lot of students just aren't showing up. And when you don't show up, that is pretty horrific. And I know there are a lot of districts that are in that situation right now. So we can do good if we get the kids in our classrooms and if we apply best practices.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm interested that you mentioned that the Stanford High School, because one of my personal friends, his daughter goes to that school, and she was an intern at Green Ninja last year, an exceptional student, and the family is very motivated around education and felt that, at least around here, that was the best learning environment for her. But it obviously is not like that for everyone. And I think we're seeing that in this remote learning environment. So today, what I'm interested in exploring are those kind of silver linings and where, you know, how is this going to move us forward in some way? So I know that you're teaching college students right now. And so, Matt, how did you prepare for remote learning this summer for the classes that you're teaching this semester?
Well, admittedly, I have a lot more experience than a lot of other people, having put together some fully online classes, done research on fully online and educational technology tools. But nonetheless, even still, when we developed our Professional Development Institute for Teachers this summer, and that was really valuable for me because I learned a lot of new tools from the teachers there. They, each one of them brought something to the table and their experience with what was working in their classrooms. And so listening to those stories was the first way I prepared. And then the second thing I did is I took my entire curriculum for each of my courses and basically wrote down what I thought the essential things were. And then I remapped it into how I could do this online. And so this is with somebody that has an infinite supply of time, sometimes it seems like. I started from scratch and just said, okay, what do I want to accomplish? And what of my tasks that I've done in the past can I translate to online, and which can I not? And so it was a big rethinking with this new venue in mind.
Yeah, and that sounds familiar to what we were trying to do with Green Ninja as well this summer, those same kind of questions. I wanted to remind you, Matt, of a situation we had together this summer. And, you know, one of our earlier podcasts, we were talking about the silver linings and looking for them. But this summer, I remember one occasion where we were working on a lab for our program, and we decided to create a video of the lab. So the students can't do the lab right now because they don't have access to the materials, but they could watch this video. And then we could give them the data that results from that experiment that we were doing. And I remember you made a comment about this as potentially being quite helpful for students. Can you explain?
Yeah. Remember in NGSS that a lot of what we're trying to do is get ourselves to a richer, more full picture of science. You know, it's not just a very narrow part of things. And there's so many more science practices that we should be doing. And one of the practices that's often overlooked is the analyzing and interpreting data aspect of things. And partly because we spend so long giving our students these great hands-on opportunities to actually do stuff and do investigations in our classrooms, that they don't always get as much time to analyze the data, and we don't have as much time to support them through that analysis. And so in some senses, taking away the actual doing of the thing and getting right to the analysis can actually really help us focus in on that kind of more important skill in many ways. Because quite honestly, most of the tabletop lab experiments that we do, that's not authentic science. There's very little that looks like that in a cutting edge, state of the art, PhD level science thing. You're going to need to learn new techniques and different things. And what you learn in a tabletop version doesn't always translate very well, especially if you're not thinking about what's going on and what you're doing, and if you're not thinking about what the data look like and just constantly learning to look at data and find stories in them. And that's what we can do when we take away the doing, for better or for worse.
It really reminds me of my experience with graduate students in our program, and you might have a similar experience, Matt, is that the graduate student who's going to do a two-year degree spends 1.75 years developing the model, gathering the data, doing some, you know, important parts of science, but it ultimately is around gathering data or developing a model, a computer analysis. But the analysis, the data analysis piece, is the last piece. And a lot of times I feel it falls a little short, that they spent a lot of their time, too much of their time, in that first part and not doing the analyzing, interpreting data. So I share this thought with you that this does give us an opportunity for students to spend potentially more time doing that piece. And so
it's also why in our department, many of our masters turn from 2 years into three, because that data analysis piece is so important, and it doesn't pull through in just those 2 years. So especially if students don't have a lot of experience with it. And so,
yeah, when I got my master's at Cal State Northridge, it took me 3 years as well. For probably that same reason. I wanted to ask you, I was talking to a colleague and this came up a few years ago, there was an interest in the flipped classroom model. And I'm curious, you know, what happened to that? Did that work out? And how is what we're doing today, is that similar or different?
You know, I actually need to do more of my homework on how the research has panned out in the last few years around flipped classrooms. But I know from my personal experience of trying things out, the biggest obstacle that I've faced is my students feeling like I'm not teaching them because they're not getting their lecture in class. And so I think that some of that has been alleviated a little bit in the last few years as students are just getting a little bit more used to learning through recorded videos. And so what I'm seeing a lot of teachers doing right now is producing some of their core essential lectures as the online asynchronous components, and then getting to the synchronous parts where we actually do the work of discussing, thinking about teamwork, collaborating. And that is it's what the flipped classroom was designed to help us accommodate, and kind of what synchronous versus asynchronous teaching requires of us, is that there's no reason for everyone to be sitting there and watching you lecture synchronously. There never was, which is why flipped classrooms exist. And now we can actually do that. It's a good way for us to help make the classroom more accessible to students who might have a lot of distractions when they need to watch those lecture parts and need to minimize the amount of time that they're doing a synchronous session where they can actually sit with you and get some human interaction, because that's the one thing that a fully asynchronous class is harder to do, is give human aspects of things.
Yeah. I mean, what implications do you think this model will have for English language learners?
Well, obviously, if we are delivering our content using a flipped classroom model where we've got nice visuals, where we've got the chance for the students to rewind and rewatch the parts that are most challenging, the chance for them to see it through multiple modalities, if there's captioning on it, if we work for state institutions like ours at the Cal State system, we're required to caption everything properly and not just let YouTube do its mediocre to good job. But
are you doing captioning, Matt?
I'm afraid that I sit there and caption all of my videos, which is a very good motivation to keep them short.
Gosh, you are a star, Professor. Yeah. Anyhow, they're well done. I wanted to, speaking of your specialties, I know that you have spent a lot of time thinking about professional learning, and we'll talk about that more maybe in an upcoming episode. But I heard recently from one of my colleagues that her PD registrations were up 100% from the number she was getting last year. So, Matt, in your experience, do teachers like online PD? And has something changed over the last, since the pandemic started?
At this point, I'm not sure whether they like it or whether it's they felt like it was essential that they get some tools. So yes, our institute at Northridge, I don't know if it was 100%. I would guess closer to 200%. We really had hundreds of people apply. We actually had to turn away a lot more than we normally would with our summer institute. And certainly the flexibility. I know I had a number of our teachers that commented on how they've wanted to apply to our institute in the past, but because of childcare issues, they weren't able to participate, but they found a way to do it. And we all had kids coming and sitting on our laps at various points in the day. And that seemed to be a pretty acceptable thing among a group of teachers. And that opened up new doors for PD for people that didn't normally have that. And that's fantastic. So people like that flexibility. We're able to, Northridge, we restricted our institute to a relatively local group of people because we wanted to be able to continue relationships with them. But we have run a number of short one-day workshops, and those have just been filled like crazy. And then when you and I presented at that unconference, I don't remember how many people, I was 500 people on a Zoom session or something like that we presented to. It was probably the biggest audience I've ever had.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I was talking to a colleague about 6 months ago, okay, maybe a little longer, pre-pandemic, and he was encouraging us at Greninja to think about online PD more carefully. He believed that there was that could be a value to some teachers. And I think we're seeing this now that, I wouldn't have to commute or drive through traffic. I know from our standpoint, in terms of at Greninja, now we can have some of our curriculum developers who we've been working with for years, but who live in Alaska or live in New York, they can participate in our trainings much more easily because we're not doing strictly just face-to-face. But what are we missing, Matt, when we're doing this online in terms of that, working with teachers individually?
Well, I know that the biggest thing I'm feeling like as an instructor in my classes is that there's a lot more overhead to having students collaborate. I can send them into breakout rooms, and with my college students, they work flawlessly. With high school and middle school students, I've been hearing a lot of concern that people don't feel comfortable sending their kids into breakout rooms because they can't monitor them. But even when there are no classroom management issues, the overhead, I can't just say to my students, hey, everybody, turn to your partner and talk with them. And so much happens when you turn to your partner and talk with them. The room just gets abuzz with energy and discussion. And We can't do that as easily. And then, of course, I can't interrupt them and say, hey, wait, oops, I forgot to mention something. I need to clarify this. Or I was just overhearing this discussion. I want to share that with everybody. And so we have to spend a lot more time transitioning into those group activities, and they're much less natural. And I think that that is a problem, because so much of what research tells us is how important it is that we have our peers learning from each other and working together and sharing ideas. And so that's what's missing.
Yeah, that is a very good point. I'm going to invite you to do something right now, Matt. I want you to close your eyes and imagine this. In X months from now, where X is a number that, you know, greater than one and less than 10, a vaccine comes out that is safe and effective. And this vaccine is easy to produce, and there's widespread distribution of the vaccine across the world, including the United States. The pandemic's over, and we're all happy to return to school. So this is a great image, right?
Mm-hmm.
But can you tell me, what does school look like? Are we going to go back to business as usual? Or, you know, is there something we can take from this experience and apply in the post-COVID world?
Well, I think that definitely so many of us have developed resources that can help supplement a face-to-face instruction. And, you know, when we did a really good video that explained something, I'm not going to get rid of that video. I'm going to keep that for my students as a resource, possibly even doing more flipped classroom-like things where I'm using those videos that I took the time to produce and getting them to the students in their homework environment. And then they come to class and we do more important things there where we discuss and share ideas and they ask questions. And so I think that we'll have a few more resources under our belts in some ways. Green Ninja's curriculum as well. We'll have a whole new option and modality for delivery because of what we produce there that I don't think we're going to want to get rid of because it's got some value to it. And hopefully a lot of other teachers will have that as well. I know that they don't have a team of curriculum developers working with them in most cases, so they may not have quite as many resources that they're really proud of to keep around, but I think that there will be a lot of them. And I also think just that the creativity that people are having to have as they try and come up with how do I make this work, they're going to learn some things from that. I don't remember if I've ever told you about my teaching at San Quentin and how I taught inside the prison there. And we had so many restrictions on what we could do. We couldn't bring in hardly any visual aids, any materials, but it forced you to get creative with your teaching. You know what you want to accomplish and you figure out a way to make it work. And some of those things are really wonderful and portable and continue and persist. And we'll keep those. And then we'll be really happy to be back together face-to-face, mostly because, of course, we're probably going to get more of our students coming back. This is one of the things in middle schools and high schools are seeing is just low participation rates. And we need to get those kids back in our classes. And that's the biggest part.
Yeah. So I feel the same way, is that, you know, we've learned some things in the last few months that we don't want to, you know, get rid of. And we want to continue to take that, what we've learned, and apply it. But we will be happy to have students back in the classroom for sure. So let's turn our attention now to climate change and the environment, where we review some of the latest news in this area and talk about how to bring such topics into our schools and classrooms. So I'm going to tell you a quick story, Matt. As you know, I grew up in Santa Monica, and my parents moved there in the 70s to escape the hot summers of Los Angeles. We lived in Hollywood at the time before we moved to Santa Monica. And in the 80s, I decided to attend college at your workplace, Cal State Northridge. And I clearly remember how hot September was when I arrived there as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked. Now I'm a climate scientist. I understand that summer heat waves are normal, especially in September. But I just looked up 1983 September temperatures when I first started at Cal State Northridge. And the high temperature in September was 104 degrees, which is hot. This is etched in my brain because I was like a Santa Monica boy, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's so hot in the valley. But now I looked up the high temperature this weekend where you live, and I saw a high temperature of 120 degrees in Van Nuys. What was that like, Matt?
And actually, I think in just around the corner in Woodland Hills, which is one of our neighboring towns, 121, which is the highest temperature ever recorded in Los Angeles County. And Los Angeles County includes Palmdale and Lancaster, which are desert communities, which are always hot. But we have recorded the highest temperature ever there. And oh my gosh, it was warm. We put blankets up over all of our windows and sort of, it's like we were in mourning here. And yeah, very hot.
What was the air quality like? Was it okay?
Well, I think that a lot of the state has actually had much worse air quality. We happen to be spared from the direction that the winds are traveling with the fires. We've had fewer fires blowing poor air quality near us, but it's not good air quality, but it's certainly not, it's not as bad as actually Palmdale and Lancaster right now have. There's a fire there that's been blowing smoke into their community and it's much worse. So that's, unfortunately, that's the cause of most of our air quality woes in California these days.
You know, up here in the Bay Area where I am, we're in our 21st spare the air day in a row. So we've had 21 days of unhealthy air. So it's been pretty tough. Anyhow, it was hot up here too. And my weather station was 111 in Mountain View. So we noticed all of that. So kind of shifting back to education, Matt, can you think of an SEP or CCC that teachers could use to go along with this phenomenon that the temperature reached, 121 in your neighborhood on September 6th?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this actually in one of my textbook that I've written for earth science. I talk about something similar to this where there was a day a couple of years ago where I think it was warmer in December in Anchorage, Alaska than it was in Jacksonville, Florida. And you're starting to see crazy phenomena like that happening all over the world and all over California. And so here we are. Get this really hot temperature. So what's going on? Well, we can really look at data. Let's start taking a look at that and doing that data analysis that we were talking about before. That's my SCP that I would look at here and plot it up for your community and start seeing things. Because of course, as climate aficionados know, you can't just tell the story with a single day and say, oh my gosh, it was so hot today. That's not the issue. It's more that we are seeing things that have never been seen before, temperatures that have never been seen before. We're seeing them happening regularly, more often. We can look at climate models and see what's predicted and see that formerly in this area, in the sort of 80s and before when you were here, we had about 8 or 9 extreme heat days a year. That's above 100 degrees. And we always joke that the first week of classes here at CSUN is usually the hottest day of the year.
Yeah.
So your experience is not uncommon, but that was a handful of days, or you could fit it on two hands. And the models are predicting that by 2040, that we could easily be getting up to 40 days a year, which is 40, 50, somewhere in there. That's more than a month solid of greater than 100 degree heat days. So this is getting to be the new normal, is that word that's being used to describe, and looking at the statistics of normal distributions and what used to be outlier days are now more central. And you can really look at those statistics, and not even the statistics aspect of it. You can just look at the distributions and see those and start asking questions like, wow, how often is this going to happen? And how high can it get now? Can we predict what the new Eugene of 2025 is going to feel like? What's that? What is that temperature going to look like? Or 2030, are those temperatures going to be, can we predict them? Is it going to be hotter? So
what is the cause and effect relationship there?
Yes. And what can we do about it is, of course, where we really want our students to go is to say, this is not inevitable. This is what the models show. If we don't do anything, and we have a chance to do things.
To get involved.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a nice transition to our final topic of every podcast, and that's about burritos, something we both enjoy. And I wanted to follow up on last week's discussion on salsa. So for me, salsa is a big part of any delicious burrito eating experience. And I have my own personal favorites. I think you've been there with me before, Matt. Near San Jose State, there's a small chain of taquerias called La Victoria that have this amazing orange sauce that for many folks, including myself, turns an ordinary burrito into a beautiful work of art. Mm-hmm. Everyone here knows La Vic and their amazing orange sauce. And after our discussion last week about salsas, I started thinking that this orange sauce could be a great phenomenon for students in the classroom. So Matt, what do you think? Could we use orange sauce as a phenomenon, and what could we do with this?
Well, first, can you describe it a little bit more? It's been a while since I had the chance to be up there with you.
Oh, I'm happy to do that in all its glory. So it's so funny because they just call it orange sauce. They don't say what's there. We believe there's habaneros in there. It's kind of an orange creamy sauce that's delivered in this bottle. And they claim it's vegan. So, and many people have tried to figure out what's in it. Safeway tried to buy the sauce from them. They didn't want to sell it. So it's this mystery recipe. It is a little bit spicy, but has a really nice creamy taste and flavor. And I've often thought that if there was a way that we could connect our Green Ninja curriculum with orange sauce and provide it to teachers and students, that students would happily eat vegetables and enjoy a rich flavor to go along with the science experience. So, we'll go back to the phenomenon idea.
Yes. Yeah, so all right. So this is I'm going to probably go where I would with any cooking experience and how I tie that into science. And I think there's some really good ones to do, which is that I think that this is an engineering challenge, actually, that you've introduced to us. I want to know what's in there and what if I can recreate the essence of that. So I need to think about
Matt,
parameters.
So do I want to know that, too.
So we want to figure out the parameters of what is it, what are the criteria that we have that makes this orange sauce so amazing, and how, what are those metrics, the right level of spiciness, the right level of creaminess, and really trying to articulate those. That's defining the problem. And then we start trying to think about what ingredients have the properties that we need. So we're thinking about brainstorming and that part of the engineering design process, but really that is a material properties sort of thing. And what happens when you mix the properties together, you mix materials together, do the properties change? You have to be careful. You can't just take, I think I want this and that, and then put them together and hope that you get this and that, because sometimes this and that don't, there's the chemical reactions that happen and things change. And so you do basically the recipes. You try and treat a recipe and recreating an experience as a design challenge. And I have this for fifth grade as a pancake engineering activity that's in our California framework. And I have students try and create pancakes from scratch using relatively restrictive vegan and low sugar ingredients. And it works pretty well sometimes, and sometimes the kids don't. They miss their fluffy pancakes that they can't quite recreate. So your experience might also be an experience in failure as well, which is another part of NGSS. Is you try to recreate that perfect orange sauce, and you find that you are simply unable to, which is going to keep La Victoria Salsa Your Taqueria in business for many years to come, because you won't succeed.
It is. I have tried a number of times to recreate that. Well, that's a great suggestion, Matt. And I don't know if you remember, but in grade 7, unit 3, that's our food unit, and students create recipes for a low-carbon cookbook for the class. And maybe we can encourage some of the students in some of our classes to think about the salsa piece or a condiment.
Or really anything, and really trying to introduce an engineering aspect of that. You're not just trying to create this recipe just for fun, but you're really trying to refine it. That's a big part of our pancake engineering, is you don't just create that recipe, but you fail a lot. You do, and you have to figure out, how do I change this and take the good parts and improve it? And that aspect of engineering design is something that we really try and emphasize, is that you do need to fail and retry.
Yeah, that iterative cycle is so important. Well, this seems like a great place to stop. Thank you for joining us at Ask Matt, where we explore NGSS, science education, and the environment with education expert and nice guy, Matt Delasio. Thanks again for another great show, Matt.